to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And it's still Black History Month, so we're going to talk some black stuff today.
Extremely.
The blackest of the black.
So today we are discussing Brother Malcolm X. And we're just going to talk about a few things that I think it's disingenuous to have a conversation, some of the conversations we've had about black leadership, black faith in America, affirming blackness in your worship experiences, and not giving some attention to this other very pivotal leader that helped us get on the path that we find ourselves on today. Like, he was the embodiment of the cold shower. You know, even if America thought that it was warming up to, if it ever thought that it was warming up to embracing civil rights or somehow righting its wrongs toward the black community, this person's larger than life persona always gave pause to the establishment. And hindsight being 2020, that pause was righteous because he was asking the questions that purposely did not go through the refinement and the filtration that some of the other leaders might have found themselves sending their words through. So we're just going to break it down real quick.
Yeah, Malcolm is one of those figures where, for various reasons, and we're going to talk through them, he's not brought up in the conversation. When you talk about Black History Month and you celebrate all of the many black heroes and leaders that we've had, mm-hmm. Malcolm's name doesn't really come up that much.
And even when it does come up, it's like
people
snapshot.
Not sure, yeah. People not sure if they should say Malcolm X or
say,
you
know, it.
Cause
say it
with
your whole.
They knew what some of the problems
with
were.
Your chest.
So they're like, can I count him in this list with Martin and, you know what I'm saying, Ida B. Wells and different
mm-hmm.
people like that?
Mm-hmm.
Can I count him with Frederick Douglass?
Mm-hmm.
And we're here to say, hell yes, you can
yes,
count Malcolm.
And you
in
better.
There. Yeah. All right, so Malcolm X, born Malcolm Little, May 19th, 1925.
Okay.
Omaha, Nebraska.
All right.
Okay. He was born to Earl Little and Louise Little, and both of whom were very staunch Marcus Garvey supporters. Now, for those who don't know Marcus Garvey was a champion of black nationalism. And that's basically the belief that black people should control their own economies
mm-hmm.
and politics and politicians. So this philosophy is kind of born out of segregation, and the country had policies to herd black people into specific areas. Those areas were, one, away from white people, but also to cluster them so that they were all together. So Garvey's saying, you know, if you got us already here,
mm-hmm.
we should at least be controlling these communities that you've created
mm-hmm.
for us, because we still here. And then you have white people who are not in the community controlling and making decisions on our behalf.
Right.
And so black nationalism says this should be ours. Now, ideally, they wanted their own land. That was not available, but segregation had a pseudo solution for that,
right,
and the fact that you've just placed us all in the same place.
So the flip side to that is that, yes, segregation did place us all in the same place, but the one thing that segregation did that was positive for the community is that it forced the community to produce a black alternative to whatever service or whatever product needed to be provided. So you had a lot of strong African-American rooted led businesses because there was a market in serving your people, mainly because other people would not.
Right.
And it wasn't until we put an economic lens on, and Garvey was good at it. Garvey was good at showing that there was an economic reason to place this umbrella of black nationalism over that entrepreneurship. The fact that, you know, even if we were going to severely underfunded and under serving schools, they were black schools. They employed black teachers. And in those environments, you could talk about things that were important to black people. So he was just putting like a comforter, if you will, on top of the bed that had already been made that said that there is a strong black community and we want to capitalize on this momentum and have certain outcomes and things. Now, the economics of the situation said that that's where things got a little testy for us on a national scale and then in certain communities. So the background to the evolution of the world that created Malcolm Little is that you started to see a lot more of those race riots where people were aiming at disrupting the economic engines that had become a byproduct of ghettoizing Black folks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So Earl and Louise Little are hearing this and saying, yes, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And Earl, so much so that he starts this foundation called the United Negro Improvement Association. And this is in Nebraska. And this starts to gain some traction and also some attention from some unwanted people. So he ends up moving his family to Milwaukee and
okay.
then to Lansing, Michigan. And so he continues his efforts in this association. And then the houses burned down in Michigan. So uh-huh. the family homes burned. And then shortly after that, he's killed by the Black Legion, which is a white supremacist
yeah.
group.
Like a
northern Ku Klux Klan.
Uh-huh.
And these Black Legionnaires beat Earl Little to death. And then they placed him alongside some railway car tracks or
yes.
streetcar tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And through a series of unfortunate events, and because, you know, this is how they treated Black people during this
mm-hmm.
time.
The brutalization the
coroner,
of Black bodies.
Yeah, the coroner ruled his death an accident. So
bullshit.
They basically said he fell on train tracks or streetcar tracks and died. But this was after he had been beaten to death
mm-hmm.
and then placed under there so the streetcar could run over him.
Mm-hmm.
So because the medical examiner did that, Louise Little couldn't receive the benefits to help her raise this family now of six children.
Yep.
And so this becomes an issue financially. And now this was a family that was together.
Right.
They, you know, people say about single parents or whatever. Single parents are great, but this family wasn't intended.
Right.
They weren't set up this way.
And I don't want to brush past that because the terrorizing of Black families, usually aimed at taking out one of the adult members of the family, most likely the male. When you talk about how does that physical terrorism and that economic terrorism work hand in hand, when the coroner decides that your murder is an accident and your insurance company can then come behind that and say it's an accident by your own hand and there's some hidden clause in your policy that will keep us from paying out, you realize that you've been paying into a benefit that because of the invisible structures of racism, they decide that you caused your own death due to your lack of conforming or your lack of respect. They would never write that down. But I just wanted to take a moment to say that because it's something that comes up even when people now, you know, our contemporaries, oh, we need more Black businesses. Why don't Black people run their own businesses? It is because of the very real physical threat. I'm not saying that all people feel that, but you have to know that when you disrupt the family, and you disrupt not only its makeup, but you disrupt how it gains resources for itself. You can banish those generations to poverty. They can't easily replace that. So if a person was only making $5,000 a year, if that, I mean, in those dollars, and the life insurance policy was for a year's salary, which would have definitely anchored them and allowed this right. newly single parent with all these children to kind of right her ship. When you deny her that on top of the trauma that her husband was brutalized and murdered, on top of the trauma that she could think that this could happen to her children, you destabilize a family for generations. You didn't just do that to her. You didn't just do that to him. You did that into the generations of their family. Okay,
so
keep going.
The result of this is, okay, she's struggling to raise the children. She's not paid the benefit. Then this is on top of being forced out of Omaha, Nebraska, being forced out of Milwaukee, being burned out of Lansing, Michigan, and then
mm-hmm.
losing her husband to racial violence.
Mm-hmm.
Then after struggling, trying to take care of these kids, she has a mental break and ends up in Kalamazoo State Hospital. Okay, so we're telling you this because one, we want to first bring Louise Little to the front. Like this is the struggle that was,
yep.
this was forced upon her.
Yep.
This is not anything that she did, and trying to do the best she can to raise her children in this situation. I mean, she actually remarried, and when she got pregnant, the husband left. So that left another child, and it was just a bad, and this is the environment that Malcolm is growing up in.
Yep.
And he's seeing all of this white anger, this visceral rage, and how it affects his family. It's disrupting them. It's moving them around. It's burning them now. It's killing them.
Yep.
Then it's hurting his mother. And so Malcolm, he was a smart student, but he dropped out of school at 13 because the teacher said, Malcolm wanted to be a lawyer, and the teacher said that's not a reasonable dream for a Negro.
Right.
So Malcolm got upset and left school. But that's his white teacher telling him, you can't be that. What you think. Why can't you be that?
Right.
So then Malcolm, he does this.
And keep in mind, this is 1930s. We have our schools. Old. We have HBCUs, but no one's feeling like they have to pour that into their children. You have to paint this picture. It's too easy to say Malcolm X was radical without understanding. And even, you know, you read the book, you read the autobiography of Malcolm X, or you have access to historical texts, or even if you saw the movie, you have to understand the environment that created him. So to him, he had an enemy. You know, evil had a face. It looked like something. Mm-hmm. So other people might have used pretty language about it and might have been confused about it. But for him, from losing family homes to being chased out of different cities to the murder of his father to losing his mother to the mental anguish of dealing with all of that, the enemy had a face.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really a black face.
Right. So Malcolm moves to Boston. He's doing odd jobs there. He's working numbers. He's running in numbers. We should really do a show about the economic engine that was the numbers in the black community.
Like, we should. I have a lot to say about that.
Yeah, so anyway, Malcolm.
Shout out to my daddy.
He participated in that. And then he moved to Flint, Michigan, and then to Harlem. That's where he settled. Now, in Harlem, he's about 18 years old when he gets there. He's there for like 3 years. And then in a robbery, they steal some stuff. For some reason, he takes the watch in to get fixed at a pawn shop and is arrested when he picks it up at 21. Okay, so 21 years old, this is, okay, so you got a young man who's still finding his way. Now, for some people, they do blackface, you know, when they're 24 and they should get credit for being young. But Malcolm wouldn't get that type of credit.
Of course not.
So he goes to jail. Now, at this point, Malcolm doesn't want anything to do with religion. Religion hasn't helped him at all.
Nope.
I mean, he's been on his own since he was 13 because he couldn't be a burden to his mom, who actually wasn't there anymore after she had her issues with mental health. So he's been trying to find his way all this time. He's in jail. His brother, Reginald, starts to tell him about the Nation of Islam.
Okay.
Malcolm doesn't want to hear anything about it until Reginald writes him a letter that says, if you stop eating pork, stop smoking cigarettes, whatever, I can get you out of jail. That sounds good to Malcolm.
Right.
So Reginald comes and visits him, and he says, look, he tells him about the Nation of Islam. Now, the Nation of Islam, their creation mythology is basically black people were the first people on earth. There was a black scientist named Jacob who created the white race as the devil. And this is why they act this way. Now, just to clarify, we talked about this in our Black Faith in America. The Nation of Islam is different from Orthodox Islam.
Yes.
So this is definitely not the creation story that you see in Orthodox Islam. But when Malcolm hears this, when he hears that the black person was the original person and the white person is the devil, this aligns with his reality, his lived experience.
It makes sense to him.
So he's like, I'm not really about religion, but this is great. I mean, this actually explains a lot. So that's the thing. If you don't want to be a devil, stop acting like the devil. That's what I'm saying. Like, if you don't want people to think that about you,
easily.
You can't. So he actually starts to write Elijah Muhammad in 1953, I guess. And he gets out of jail. They have this correspondence, and Elijah Muhammad brings him to the house, and they start this relationship. 1955, he's ordained a minister in the Nation of Islam, and that starts Malcolm
X. The saga. So let's talk a little bit about the nation. So the Nation of Islam at this time, it's not equal in size, but it is this equal and opposite energy that to what is gathering through traditional, what we would call traditional Black churches, focused on lifting up the people. So it is popular mostly in urban centers, whereas our churches are still popular. Our churches are popular everywhere, but there's still a high, what we would call suburban now, rural presence with our regular Christian churches, as well as, you know, some large anchor Black congregations in certain areas, your AMEs, your Baptist churches. As we know, Martin Luther King was affiliated with numerous Baptist churches, Christian churches, not least of which is Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Atlanta. And I wasn't thinking about Ebenezer. I'm thinking about Four Little Girls in Birmingham.
Oh, the Birmingham. I can't remember the name.
It escapes me. But these churches are become prominent happenings of events in this civil rights movement. The Nation, as I understand, and just the things that I've been exposed to, was an alternative in these urban centers where Blacks had migrated looking for a better quality of life and might have found that Northern and urban racism was as bad, if not worse, than what they had experienced, let's say, a generation before. So it's this alternative. And in centering the Black experience and Blackness, it became very important to see yourself, and we've talked about this. Can you see yourself affirmed in your spiritual text? Can you see yourself affirmed when looking at the leadership of your body? And how does the leadership affirm you? How do they talk about you? And I think that this is where they gain traction. You know, when you go to Harlem now and Harlem, USA, you can still see the remnants of what this aspect of the movement, the roots that they put down in this large urban center. And this was, again, a part of the world that created the man who became Malcolm X.
Yeah. So the Nation of Islam is a Black American focused view of Muslim theology. Mm-hmm. So this is the experience that of Black people in America. What's interesting about this, and I don't want to go too much on the tangent here, but in learning about like the biblical creation myth and what happened and why it mirrors other creation myths, like you learn that the Hebrews were coming out of slavery, hundreds of years of slavery, and this was with the Babylonians, and they heard these Babylonian creation myths. Mm-hmm. So the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Babylonian creation story. And so they're out of slavery now, and they're like, they're not Israel yet. They're just Hebrew ex-slaves. Mm-hmm. And so they're saying like, well, who are we? And so what they want to do is start to establish a national identity. And so part of that is creating a creation story for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they do this, and this is what you get in the stories in Genesis, the creation stories in Genesis 1 and 2. And this is born out of other myths. Now, there was a prophet, Ezra, in chapter 9, verse 1. He's basically explaining to them, you may not want to do this just yet, because we just got out of this thing and we're still tied to these other customs, and we've been hearing all of this stuff, you know, for all this time. His point is basically, we're too close to the lifestyle and beliefs of the people who oppressed us. We don't want to do this right now. We need to separate ourselves. They were like, nah, let's do it. So they created this whole story. And when you learn, well, what I'm learning, you know, is this is going on, like how they arrived at this creation story. I was talking to one of my professors, and I was like, well, if they did this, if this was basically like their literal way to establish the literary way to establish a national identity, why doesn't anyone else just do, you know, just make up their own? Like, because this is what they did. They took elements of the Babylonian creation story and the Gilgamesh epic and put that together, changed it a little bit because they didn't want to look like they're enslaved. And then they made their own. Mm-hmm. And the professor said to me, well, he was like, yeah, that's right. I mean, he said the only thing that's close to that is what the Nation of Islam did. They created their own creation story mm-hmm. to affirm them the same way the Hebrews created one to affirm themselves. Mm-hmm. And so while I don't agree with the Nation of Islam creation story, I do appreciate the fact that somebody tried to make something that was affirming to the black people right. who were oppressed the right. same way that the Hebrews did as they escaped their enslavement. So anyway, the Nation of Islam now, Malcolm, when he joins it, it's like roughly like 200 to 500 people. Those mm-hmm. are the estimates. He's grown this ministry now to like 50 to 75,000 people. A lot of influence.
Yep.
Okay, so he becomes a minister. He's speaking all over the place now. He's a minister to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Now, Elijah Muhammad is not the one going out doing all the speaking nearly as much as Malcolm. Mm-hmm. Malcolm is the mouthpiece for this movement.
Yep.
And he is a charismatic, persuasive, mm-hmm. like enthralling yeah. mouthpiece. Like yeah. if you listen to Malcolm speak.
He is an engaging, enthralling orator.
It was a long time before I actually just sat and listened to the stuff that Malcolm was saying. And I'm like, yo, he was right about a lot mm-hmm. of things. Like the way he viewed the plight of the black American is one, so pertinent to what's going on today, but also so articulate of what was happening during his time.
Exactly. He was very, very good at calling a thing a thing. Extremely right. good. So for sometimes the best way to reach your audience is to keep it as simple as possible. And he was adept at speaking very plainly, using whole language, not mincing his words, not asking for permission to use these words, to describe conditions that bring about despair for black folk. And being able to do that, you have to look at the fact that in and of itself is a threat, because of one of the most often used tools in supremacy is this gaslighting, like saying that's not what it is. It's not that. You're just seeing it the wrong way. And I think that the one thing that he took from his detractors was their ability to use flowery language around his very straightforward words mm-hmm. describing his own position. That's a power position to be in already, because I'm not asking you to tell me what condition I'm in. I'm telling you what condition I'm in.
His experience spoke so loudly. So he wasn't educated like King was.
Nope.
He left school. This is him observing the world and through his own self-study, learning to give voice to what he's experiencing.
Exactly.
So he starts to build up this Nation of Islam, and the problems start to arise when the nation becomes so big and Malcolm becomes such a prominent figure that people are starting to see that he's more out there than Elijah Muhammad, and they get jealous about that. And so mm-hmm. That, and then there was an incident with the police where they put the LAPD attacked the Nation of Islam members, and Elijah Muhammad just forbade them from responding, because mm-hmm. the Nation of Islam had this protection arm called the Fruit of Islam, yep. and they were trained fighters to protect. Like and this is the thing about most groups that we see, like Black Panthers, like they don't initiate action. They respond to action initiated against yep. them. And this was the Fruit of Islam. And so they were in the community protecting the community. Mm-hmm. And then if the police came in, they stood as a protecting force against white supremacist police force officers. That would come in. Mm-hmm. And so when the LAPD attacked the Nation of Islam, the Fruit of Islam were unable to respond. And so that was an issue with Malcolm. So Kennedy is assassinated. And in an interview about the Kennedy assassination, Malcolm says, "Chickens come home to roost, and I like when the chickens come home." Mm-hmm. And that initiated a media firestorm, because it was spun like he was saying he was happy that the president of the United States was assassinated.
Which was not what he was saying.
Malcolm was referring to policies that were in place, his view of policies that were in place. So the violence that the U.S. was initiating against other nations and other peoples, that he was saying that eventually came home. Right or wrong, that's what he meant. It was spun in a different way in the media. And mm-hmm. then the Nation of Islam silenced him for 90 days. He can't speak for 90 days. This is your mouthpiece now. Right around the same time in 1963, the same year this happens, Malcolm X confirms that Elijah Muhammad has these sexual incidents with the Nation of Islam secretaries.
Yep.
And so they have these young secretaries that keep getting hired by Elijah Muhammad, and Elijah Muhammad kept having sex with them. He even had a child by one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is against the rules of the Nation of Islam. Now, Malcolm, even though he wasn't about religion at first, he was really about the religious customs in the Nation of Islam. And so this was a extreme violation for him when he learned about this. And this also happens to be the person that silenced Malcolm for speaking what he believed to be a relatively innocuous truth about. I mean, he said much harsher things about things, but never about the president of the United States and never during such a sensitive time.
Mm-hmm.
So he silenced, eventually leaves the Nation of Islam in March 1964 and starts his own thing.
Right.
Muslim Mosque Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're about to get to the conversation on, this is all background. So then Malcolm leaves, right? 1964, March. Malcolm dies February 21st, 1965.
Yes.
This coming Thursday. And this is why we're doing this episode now, because it's the anniversary of the death. But during those 11 or so months,
mm-hmm,
that he was not a part of the Nation of Islam, Malcolm goes on a Hajj.
Yep.
He sees things differently outside of the Nation of Islam lens. So he sees his white Muslim brothers and Arab Muslim brothers treating him as a brother, unlike the white men in America who treated him as something to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
That brotherhood was such a powerful influence on him. He traveled to Africa, he traveled to Europe, a few other places in Europe, and then he comes back to the United States with a different mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see he's meeting with Martin now. He's aligning closely with the civil rights movement, and he's making this change away from this other influence.
Right.
February 21st, three gunmen enter the Audubon during a speaking engagement
with the
Audubon ballroom. And you see that in the movie.
An assassination.
He's assassinated by these three members of the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Shot 21 times based on a coroner report. And that is how the life of Malcolm X ends. That's tough, because we only got 11 months of Malcolm away from the Nation of Islam.
Right.
And he was on a trajectory that was really impressive.
It was impressive. It might have even been threatening, because I think what happened once he separated from the strong influence of Elijah Muhammad and the role that he had started his career walking in, he expanded his worldview. Travel will do that, taking in new information, and he had an opportunity to. Now he had something to contrast his previous experiences to. So it wasn't cut and dry, wasn't all encompassing to just say that it was going to be white American men that are this enemy. Now you've been in an organization and you've been in various relationships, and now you can assess that, you know, certain people who are not for you, who are not supporting you, do look like you, you know, and they have competing interests. So he was growing as a man. We are not we're not even talking about somebody who has the wisdom of 60 years on earth or 70 years on earth or living in various countries. We're talking about somebody who is a survivor of trauma, who has laced together a life and had a gift to not only teach others, but to impart hope with also their dignity. So Payne's a very powerful figure. The potential power of him evolving is what was cut short. Whether we think that there's some conspiracy behind his assassination, you know, there were things that were depicted in the movie that said that, you know, there were some forces that wanted to see a demise and wanted to see something negative happen. But even if you discount that, even if you say, you know what, small-minded people did a very small thing that had a huge impact and they killed a leader, he was well on his way to not so much being a follower of anybody else's movement, but he had learned the art of collaboration. He had finally learned that there were things that you could find in common with people, even if it was not the most major plank in your life. So there's no requirement that you be a member of the Nation of Islam. And there's no requirement that we adhere to the same religious practices, because we're talking about a larger issue. Some people would say that his death impacted King all the time. They're using different language to talk about these men. Oh, King is much nicer versus Malcolm is so radical, and you know, and they're lining up more radical, violent, agitating characteristics to Malcolm while still doing the same thing to Martin, but saying, but at least he's nice about it, you know. Yeah. He's taking this, you know, gentler approach. The vacuum that was left at the end of Malcolm's life, I think that that was sobering for Martin, because by this time, y'all are not enemies. Y'all are not moving in two different lanes. You've talked. You've talked to your brother. You have interacted with him. You have shared notes on what you've been doing. People who have had any sort of critique or observation of Martin 65 to 68 say that he integrated some of that language into his message. That would be alarming to people who were thinking, I'm going to have you working a certain way. Martin was the one who got an opportunity to speak to Kennedy. Martin was the one who was lobbying LBJ after Kennedy's assassination, saying, you can't let it go because Black America's going to explode. We're not going to stop, you know, marching. We're not going to stop agitating. We're not going to start using y'all's buses. We're not doing any of this stuff. You got to give us everything. You got to give us more, because you never gave us everything that we're asking for. When he started talking about economics, this is a capitalistic country. So I just think that you don't minimize the fact that when they really honed in on that racism is a thinly veiled cover for the economic disparities that Black Americans continue to experience. But there was a whole nother vein of thought on Madison Avenue, which is the advertising corridor. They come up with all types of ad campaigns. We've watched Mad Men. You'll understand what I'm talking about. But anyway, people were trying to figure out how to make a permanent consumer class, to the point where they were producing marketing materials on how to market your stuff to Black folks. Up until this point, going back to what we shared earlier about Marcus Garvey and the fact that segregation spawned and maintained and fed Black business. If you want to make a permanent consumer class, first thing you have to do is stop them from owning things. I don't want you to aspire to own it. Just aspire to buy it. And I could see if that was an accident, but I think it was a speech in early 68. Martin says, I am deathly afraid. I'm afraid that we are integrating into a burning house. Yeah. He wasn't talking about us coexisting and living together. He was talking about, are we getting ready to engage in one of the biggest wealth transfers if we start using things that are not meant for our betterment or our ownership, but only for us to become permanent customers? That's an economic question.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why Malcolm becomes a difficult or complicated figure is because he's positioned as the anti-Martin. Mm-hmm. Now, for right or wrong, there is some parallels between the two of them. Like, Martin pre-Malcolm's, well, actually, it's Martin before and after Watts. So when Martin leaves the South and goes to Watts and he sees what happens there after the riots, he's open. His eyes are open to a different Black reality. So he goes north to Chicago and he sees, oh my God, this level of destitution I've never seen.
Never seen South. Before.
That's the reality that Malcolm X was living in. And so Martin becomes this different figure, and he starts to move down the line towards the Poor People's Campaign, which is what actually ended up being the last thing that he was able to start. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Malcolm is being exposed to Orthodox Islam and seeing the world a little bit differently. And so as Martin gravitates towards Malcolm towards the end of his life, the reverse happens for Malcolm. He's coming more towards the King side. He's more in the civil rights movement. Let's try to get together. Let's try to figure this out. And that's an amazing story between the two of them.
Yep.
And the other thing that makes his life, or makes him a complicated figure, is just the amount of time he was with the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. I mean, he gave his whole life to that, except for the last 11 months. And because of the way the Nation of Islam is viewed as a Black extremist organization by the FBI, and some of the things that were said, the anti-Semitic things that were said, the things about white people that were said, that is not a favorable view of that organization.
Right.
Because of Malcolm's connection to them, that's tough. I mean, some of the things that Malcolm said himself what during his time with the Nation of Islam also makes him complicated. I mean, but one of the biggest critiques of Malcolm is he would say things like, white people are a race of devils. Mm-hmm. Now, when Malcolm makes this statement as a part of the Nation of Islam, he is not making a character assessment of white people. He's making a theological assessment of them. So he's explaining his theology. Mm-hmm. And his theology is undergirded by the actions evidenced by the white people that he's encountered. So once you understand, the reason why we went through the background of Malcolm's life is because once you understand his lens of the world, the lens through which he sees the world, you can understand why that theology makes sense to him and then why he says the things that he says. Mm-hmm. Because to him, white people have only hurt him. Yeah. They've killed his family members. They've gotten away with it. They've refused to pay out for his mom's, for his dad's death. They've impacted his mother's life. Yep. They've arrested him. They've incarcerated him. And then the first thing he hears is, hey, these people they were created to do something else, exactly what they've been doing to you this whole time. And so from a theological standpoint, that's where he comes from.
And met him where he was.
And then also, Malcolm, he says he speaks with the authority of history when he says that. And so when Malcolm starts to speak about the historical record of what white people have done to not only to blacks in America, but to people around the world, mm-hmm. history is not kind
at all.
And history is also telling the truth. So when Malcolm speaks about the truth, we have to interrogate this. Okay, so maybe we want to recoil at that. Well, you can't say all white people are so yes, you can't. But that does not mean that you do not talk about what actually happened
that contributes to this perception. What the historical record says, yes.
If Malcolm's 39 years of life, a large chunk of was spent with the Nation of Islam, and he's characterized based off of that view, how much do we characterize this group of people who has done immeasurably an immeasurable amount of harm?
Basically, he had a lot to choose from. So which is why the idea of him expanding his worldview by physically moving himself out of the United States, by traveling and by seeing it could be such a myopic view to think that American Christianity or America's version of any religion is that religion. When you go out into the world and see other followers of your religion, sometimes you're able to then decipher how much of it is American and how much of it is actually Christianity. Actually, you know,
yeah, we're gonna have to do a show on American civil religion, which is different from Christianity. So yeah. let's get there. But we interrogate that in terms of what Malcolm says. We interrogate that on this show in terms of what Christianity is responsible mm-hmm. for. When you are responsible for that type of harm, you don't get to say, let's move on and forget about it.
The gaslighting, you don't get to say that it didn't hurt as bad. You don't get to say that the impact was not as dire as it was. You don't get to say that you do not get to change how people survived interacting with you and how they describe that. That's why we always talk about owning your words. It all starts with language. And here was somebody who used whole words unapologetically. Never asked, can I say that? Should I say it like that? If anything, the wall he ran into because I'm not asking you how I'm going to say it. I'm going to say it the way that it occurs to me.
So Malcolm's truth was also two-edged. So he was critical of white people. He was also critical of black people. Mm-hmm. He said black people should not be allowing this to happen. They should not be allowing these businesses to come in and where you should be owning, you're yep. not owning, you're consuming. You should not be allowing these people to represent you. You should not be taking this through a peaceful stance through nonviolence. He was very intentional about couching responses to violence as not nonviolence, but it is an appropriate response to violence committed against you.
Exactly.
So he made an argument in a debate. I believe it was, it wasn't with James Baldwin. It was a different debate that, and these are Malcolm's words. He's saying that white people don't take that. Like white people don't say to England, you know, you've been violent against us. And so we're just going to turn the other cheek. No, you have a revolutionary mm-hmm. war. Mm-hmm. White people don't do this.
A whole ass war.
Right now in America, Christians who have a theology that says turn the other cheek stockpile weapons in the event of someone actually committing violence or being a danger to them. Mm-hmm. So Malcolm is saying, why is it okay for these other people to respond to violence in a protective or active state, but when a black person does it, they're vilified? So mm-hmm. for instance, the Black Panthers never used guns. They yep. only carried guns.
Yep.
But the image of black people carrying guns in preparation for if something were to happen to a member of their community that they were protecting, that image scared people so much. That proves Malcolm's point that, yeah, you're okay with it as long as black people aren't doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's the
harsh truth.
This is true now.
We have examples of people who have been hurt and killed in open carry states who have licenses to carry, and it is solely because of the image that and the fear that it conjures, and this idea that self-protection is not something afforded to black bodies. That thing is so deeply rooted that we've been doing, you know, we do these podcasts, we throw things up and we talk about them, but even this is not going to undo that. You know, even sending and creating 50 new history majors is not going to do that. You know, 1,000 people going out to get their gun licenses is not going to undo that. Why? Because they're just some things that until you're ready to face them, you will not be able to unseat them. And one of those things that has to be faced is how much of this state is really predicated on violence against non-white entities. You understand what I'm saying? Like,
it exists because of that.
Because of that, period, point blank, full stop. That's a sentence, new paragraph. But because people at all levels with all different motives and all different levels of understanding, they all agree that to say that and to then be open for whatever resulting conversation happens after accepting that as fact, we haven't even gotten there yet.
So the question that we're not going to answer on this show, but we would love to hear from you, is how should we interrogate Malcolm's words based on the historical record? Now, he died at 39 in 1965, and we're over 30 years from that. Is it 30 years? Is my mm-hmm. math right?
Okay. That's been over. It's been 54 years.
It's too late for me to math right now. But Malcolm said some things that actually do apply now. But how do we view this? How do we view his words? How do we view in light of his experience, in light of what he learned about the historical record? I mean, if you look at Native Americans in this country who mm-hmm. extended a hand to people who they thought they could trust, and in turn they received smallpox, in turn they received genocide. What do we say about Malcolm? Was Malcolm right?
Mm.
Or to what degree was Malcolm right?
Mm.
So, it's Black History Month. We needed to talk about Malcolm.
This is an extremely Black episode. Thank y'all.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.